Good morning, and thank you for joining us this early in the morning. Welcome to session 505, Evolution of a Prototype Archival System for Preserving and Reviewing Electronic Records. My name is Stephanie Oriabori. I'm an archivist at the National Archives. I currently work at the Presidential Materials Staff, which oversees access and policy issues related to presidential records. Previously, I was employed at the Bush Presidential Library in College Station, Texas, and the Nixon Presidential Materials Staff in College Park. It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce an impressive collaborative work underwritten by the National Archives. The Electronic Records Archive, or ERA, system is a NARA initiative to preserve and provide long-term access to uniquely valuable electronic records of the U.S. government. As NARA builds the ERA system, research into the unique challenges surrounding electronics helps provide us with clarity about our options and opportunities. The Presidential Electronic Records Pilot System, also referred to as PURPOSE, is one such research project that NARA has sponsored to help inform ERA system design and policy. The collaborative effort between archivists and computer scientists on PURPOSE has produced a prototype system that has provided invaluable insights for the development of ERA. Some of the tools developed under the auspices of PURPOSE, such as review case management and tracking of review decisions, will be brought into the ERA system as the system evolves and functionality is added on an established timeline. To that effect, PURPOSE developers provide periodic briefings to the ERA staff and to Lockheed Martin system engineers contracted to build the ERA system. Two of the individuals integral to the development of PURPOSE are here today to tell you a little bit about the system, archivist Brooke Clement and computer scientist Dr. William Underwood. Brooke Clement has been with the National Archives more than 4 years. She received her BA in History and American Culture, from the University of Michigan and an MA in American Studies from Columbia University. She started in the archival profession as a work study employee at the Columbia University Archives. Brooke worked at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan for over 2 years, where some of her duties included managing the research room, serving as a point of contact for the Gerald R. Ford Scholar Award, and assisting colleagues on exhibits and public programming. Brooke currently works at the George Bush Library in College Station, Texas. In the past two and a half years at the Bush Library, she has worked on various projects, including the presidential timeline, teacher workshops, declassification, and processing of audiovisual materials, and the redesign of the library's core exhibit. Since 2006, she has contributed to the PURPOSE research project by helping to define, test, and refine functions for Presidential Records Act and Freedom of Information Act processing of presidential electronic records. Dr. William Underwood is a member of the Georgia Institute of Technology Research faculty. He earned his PhD in computer science from the University of Maryland. His current research interests are in, and get ready, it's a long list, in developing formal theoretical foundations of investigations, formal theoretical foundations for records management in archival science, experimental investigations of alternative digital preservation strategies, the application of natural language processing, machine learning, and knowledge-based reasoning technologies to the support of archival description, Freedom of Information Act review and record search and retrieval. Dr. Underwood's current research, sponsored by the National Archives, involves prototyping of an archival repository and archival processing functions for accession, preservation, review, description, and retrieval of electronic records. Among the results of this research are tools for learning and recognizing document types, automatic description of record series, and decision support for review of presidential records for access restrictions. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Brooke.
Good morning. In the spring-summer 2008 American Archivist article, Electronic Records Planning and Collecting Repositories, Susan Davis wrote that it is incumbent upon those involved in electronic records research to develop ways for the profession to design and implement adequate and appropriate measures for acquiring, preserving, and making accessible born digital records and papers regardless of source. The Purpose Research Project is an example of such an experimental development. The research is currently being conducted at the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library in College Station, Texas. Conducting research gave us the freedom to explore different approaches to dealing with the issues we encountered. Purpose is about exploring options, not establishing policy. Its goal is to develop research technology that will help guide the National Archives and future systems dealing with processing electronic records. So first, I will briefly relate the issues we initially encountered and the approach we adopted to resolve those issues. I will also describe to you the tools we developed to review electronic records in response to PRA/FOIA requests. Then Dr. Underwood will briefly describe the system's preservation capabilities and the new technologies that we're currently investigating and developing to support archival processing. During the administration of George H.W. Bush, new computer and electronic mail technologies were available to the president and the White House staff for creating and saving records. Some of these included IBM PS2 personal computers based on the Intel 386 microprocessor chip, new operating systems such as PC-DOS, Windows 3.1, and IBM's OS 2, word processing software such as WordPerfect 5.1 and Microsoft Word 2.0, database management systems such as DBase 4 and Advanced Revelation, spreadsheet programs such as Lotus 1-2-3 and Quattro Pro, presentation programs such as Harvard Graphics, electronic messaging systems such as Digital Equipment's All-in-One, computer programs that were created by the White House staff, and document scanners for creating and storing digital images of paper records. Oops, I'm sorry. But you can see that real quick. While we knew the requirements for processing paper records, the processing of electronic records introduces new issues that we did not thoroughly understand. For instance, file name extensions alone are not adequate to identify the file formats of e-records. For instance, a .doc file extension might indicate a WordPerfect or an MS Word document. An .exe file extension usually indicates an executable program, but may also indicate a self-extracting archive, which could contain presidential records. So therefore, a file format identification tool was needed because we don't know which viewer to use until we know what the file format is. The office automation software used to create the records could not be used to view records because that software often does not operate on current computers and operating systems. Furthermore, using such software could result in the record being accidentally modified. So file viewers were needed for viewing the records on current computers without the possibility of changing the records. An archivist must open documents as fully as possible and redact only the portions that have restrictions. How can one be sure that the contents of the redacted parts of e-records are absolutely removed? We acquired redaction tools for experimentation. And there were no viewers for some of the legacy file formats that we encountered, for example, Borland Reflex databases. So we needed to be able to convert these into files other than the original file formats, which we had a file, which we had a viewer for. So we either acquired or built these tools, tested them, and learned other capabilities that were needed. As the diagram illustrates, our approach is that the computer scientists develop a set of tools that are used by archivists on e-records. The archivists then learn more about the processing requirements and report these to the computer scientists. The computer scientists then refine these tools to meet new and better understood requirements and suggest new technologies. And the result is an evolution of a prototype system called the Presidential Electronic Records pilot system, or PURPOSE. PURPOSE is a research prototype for investigating advanced technologies supporting archival decisions on processing presidential e-records. The research project is a cooperative research project between the Bush Library Archivists and the Georgia Tech Research Institute and sponsored by NARA's ERA research program. PURPOSE is an evolving research prototype which provides an environment for evaluation of the system's performance based on testing done by archivists at the Bush Library. The resulting prototype system supports the accession or ingestion, storage, arrangement, and preservation of e-records in a repository. As you are all aware, archivists review records for a variety of restrictions, statutes, deed of gift, State Freedom of Information Act restrictions, sunshine laws, HIPAA, and so on. At the Bush Library, archivists review records under the restrictions of the Presidential Records Act of 1978, or PRA, and the Freedom of Information Act, otherwise known as FOIA. Therefore, the system's developing capabilities and prototypes support the research of the repository for records relevant to a PRA FOIA request, the review of those records, and the description of those records in the form of a finding aid. Pursuant to the Presidential Records Act, all presidential records proposed for opening must be notified to both the former and current presidents, and at this time, this is not a function that has been developed or tested on the PURPOSE system. In the early stages of the PURPOSE project, each of these functions was accomplished by separate tools or programs or icons on a single computer. Now these have all been integrated into two subsystems called the Archival Repository and Archival Processing Tools, or ART and APT. Before we move on, I just want to mention that that PURPOSE is a research prototype and not an operational system. And for purposes of this presentation, all electronic records that you see today are actually open textual documents that have been scanned, OCR'd, and accessioned into PURPOSE for experimental purposes. As previously noted, the Bush administration created e-records in a variety of media. During accession, the various received records are transferred to containers in the PURPOSE repository. While we call it accession, in the presidential world, records are not really accessioned by the National Archives, but are transferred into their possession. So really, this is more correctly known as ingest, but we'll call it accession. To accession these electronic records, one uses the archival repository and selects the Add Accession from the Edit drop-down menu. When the OK button is selected after you fill in this screen, the information is added to the accession register. This description screen shows the intellectual arrangement of the accession records into collections, offices, and records series. For example, container 2006 is in the Michael Boskin files, who worked in the Council of Economic Advisors office, which is included in staff member and office files of the Bush Presidential Records. We needed the system to be able to address processing under the Presidential Records and Freedom of Information Acts, which includes closing records under the restrictions of the PRA and FOIA. In the textual world, when a request for presidential records by a Freedom of Information Act request is received from a researcher, a FOIA case number is assigned. Then all applicable databases are searched for records relevant to the request. The requester is then notified of the volume of records that is responsive, and an estimate is made of the time needed to process them. An archivist will then review just those records that are relevant, not considering an entire record series or container, but often just the contents of some of the folders within several containers. This process is called PRA FOIA processing. The PURPOSE tools first support PRA FOIA processing by providing the capability to index holdings. This function creates an index of all the terms in the textual records and holdings. To perform a search of the staff member in office electronic records and holdings, a FOIA case is created using a FOIA case number. So we have the creation of a FOIA case. Once a FOIA case is created, an archivist can perform a search of the staff member in office electronic records and holdings by translating the FOIA request into a Boolean query. This returns a result set of pointers to records that are relevant to the Boolean query. For instance, this slide shows a FOIA request for any presidential records having to do with Shirley Temple Black. After pressing search, the index of the contents of the repository is searched and we have a result set. If the archivists are satisfied with the results of the search, they save the results. And the reason that this query was written as Shirley Temple and Black was that at times her name is written as Black Shirley Temple in the documents. And this is the result set of the Shirley Temple Black FOIA query, which is then associated with the FOIA case we created. To begin testing the processing capabilities of the prototype, the archivist checks out one of the containers associated with the FOIA case to an archivist's work area, which is a temporary workspace. Other archivists who are working or are also testing the prototype cannot check out the same container until the archivist who checked it out checks it back in. And once the files have been reviewed for this FOIA case, they do not need to be reviewed for another FOIA case, but can still be associated with that additional FOIA case. The archivist then uses the review activity of the archival processing tool to review just those records in the container that are relevant to the query, not considering an entire record series or container. For example, the container illustrated here has 7 files in it, but only 6 are relevant to the request, and those files that are bold-faced indicate those files the archivist must review for the FOIA case. If the archivist chooses Chase to view, the image on the left is displayed in QuickView Plus. Some of the review actions in the APT and visible in the action drop-down menu in the illustration on the right include opening a record for public access and withdrawing or redacting a record because of access restrictions. Again, for the sake of showing you the capabilities of the system, please note that the document that you're seeing is open and full. For purposes of this demonstration, we're going to say that the document should be closed B6, which is personal privacy under the provisions of the FOIA. Back at the main screen of the APT, the archivist chooses to close the document in the action menu. After choosing close, the screen on the left opens and the archivist selects the B6 restriction under the FOIA tab. The archivist could also close or indicate any PRA exemptions too, but because the PRA is only applied in the first 12 years after the administration ends, the Bush Library archivists are no longer withdrawing under those restrictions, but it is a field that is open for testing capabilities. The miscellaneous tab is primarily used to identify which statutes under B3 the archivist is closing a document under. So the archivist then selects OK, and the box on the right opens for the archivist to enter withdrawal information. This can be done manually or is copied over from the text of the document. And if you need to see the redacted document to gather the information, it can be redisplayed by selecting View Chase.ans from the menu bar. When all of the information has been entered, except for the archivist name and date of withdrawal, which are automatically filled in, one selects OK at the bottom of the dialog box. When the archivist selects OK, the information entered into the withdrawal form is associated with that document and can be seen in the property value section of this screen. Notice, too, that the icon to the left on the file name is now shown in red, indicating that it has been closed. Those file names with green icons have already been determined to be open and full. We'll get to ones that show the green a little bit later, but we have different color associations with each of the redactions or closings or openings. Just again, this document has been open and full. If Black Letter had been reviewed in the first 12 years after the end of the administration, the archivist would have closed the entire document as P2 because it deals with an appointment to the federal office. But I'm going to use this document as an example for redaction and redact the second paragraph as B2, which restricts on the basis of internal personnel rules and practices of an agency. And let me just say that this document was never closed or redacted B2. This is just for the demonstration today. To begin, redact is selected from the action pull-down menu. Before moving on to the next slide, I would simply like to mention that the National Archives has not approved an electronic redaction tool for redacting electronic records still in the electronic world and then providing the redacted copy electronically to researchers. The Purpose Research Project investigated different redaction tools because one of the many issues confronting archivists processing electronic records. Presently, we are experimenting with three types of redaction: redaction of a TIFF image of the record, redaction of a PDF copy, and redaction of a Microsoft Word copy. For this example, we're going to use the TIFF selection here. When the TIFF document image is selected, the record is converted to a TIFF multi-page file format, and the image is loaded into Image Redactor. To redact the image, one selects the block rectangle icon from the toolbar. We place the crosshair to the upper left of the text to be redacted and click and hold down the mouse button and drag the crosshair to the lower right of the text to be redacted. Once the archivist has done this, the next step is to stamp the document with the reason for withdrawal. The archivist selects the stamp tool at the top and the reasons withdrawn dialog box opens as seen on the right. As I already stated, for demonstration purposes, we will close the selection area B2. So we will select B2 under the FOIA tab and click OK. The rubber stamp becomes the mouse cursor. The cursor is placed near the text being redacted, and the left mouse button is clicked. The identifier for the restriction is inserted at that point. Then the pointer icon is selected from the toolbar so that the restriction identifier will not be placed at other points in the text of the document. When all the text that has PRA restrictions or FOIA exemptions have been redacted and annotated, one exits the redactor and the withdrawal information dialog box is displayed. The archivist enters the information just as if they were closing it in full, as was shown a few slides ago. After saving the redacted document, the archivist is returned to the archival processing tool and can see that black letter has been reviewed because there are now two black letter files. One is the closed document and with the red icon next to the file name, and the redacted copy, which would be the copy seen by researchers, has a blue icon next to its file name. Now that all of the records, once all of the records have been seen, So now, say that we've seen all of the records and the results set for this container, and we can check the container back into Holdings. Once the containers with relevant e-records are reviewed, the archivist edits the properties of the FOIA case by indicating the number of folders in the FOIA case and describing the scope and content and the arrangement of the FOIA case. The archival repository is now used to make a FOIA collection reference container and binding aid. The Archival Repository tool creates them both at the same time. Once a FOIA reference container is created, the options of opening the FOIA reference container or the FOIA finding aid will be enabled on the file drop-down menu. This picture shows the FOIA reference collection. It shows the collections, offices, series, folders, and file names of e-records that have been opened, closed, or redacted. In this simple example, there is only one collection, office, and series in the FOIA collection. The opened or redacted files can be viewed by pointing the mouse pointer at the file name and double-clicking the left mouse button. The collection also contains file names with the file name extension WDS. These contain withdrawal sheets for e-records that cannot be disclosed to the public or can be disclosed only in part due to PRA restrictions or FOIA exemptions on disclosure. These can also be viewed by double-clicking on the file name. The picture on the right shows the withdrawal information for the chase file that we previously closed in full. Finally, this slide shows the FOIA finding aid that was generated from the information that was entered by the archivist and from the FOIA collection itself. Now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Underwood, and he's going to describe some of the archival preservation features of Purpose and some of the new technologies that are being developed to assist archivists in processing electronic records.
During review, an archivist may encounter a file that cannot be viewed. So they're unable to review it for possible restrictions on disclosure. Why might they not be viewable? Well, some files may be encrypted so that there's a need to recover a password and decrypt the file so that it can be viewed. Other files may be corrupted due to media deterioration or file transmission errors, so there's a need to attempt to repair them. Some PC files may be obsolete or in a proprietary format that can no longer be viewed, and so there's a need to convert them to a file format for which we do have a viewer. And so at the left here are of the slide are the things that the system needs to be able to do. The archivist can switch from the review activity into the preservation activity and get support for creating a viewable file that they can use during review. Currently, PURPOSE has the capability to recognize about 500 legacy and current file formats. Most of these can be associated with viewers. For instance, the picture on the right shows the association of an ARJ self-extracting archive with a viewer for that file format. Archive and self-extracting file formats can also be associated with archive extractors, as seen in the picture at the left. Extractor up there at the top above viewer. Password-protected files can also be associated with password recovery programs and with programs that decrypt the password-protected files, given the password. Damaged files can be associated with repair programs that may be able to repair the file fully or in part. Finally, files that have no viewer can be converted to file formats that do have a viewer. We'll give just one preservation example. In this slide, the archivist has encountered a file demo RXD that does not have a viewer. The file contains a Borland reflex database. They can switch to the preservation activity, highlight the file name of the unviewable file, and select Convert from the Action pull-down menu. Because of the association of the file type, Borland Reflex Database, with the converter, the file is converted to a viewable file shown on the following slide. This is an ASCII text file that can be viewed or loaded into a spreadsheet or database viewer. It's tab delimited ASCII file. The converted file does not replace the original file, but is associated with that file as the same record, but in a different format. The prototype system that we're developing does not implement just the manual archival process. In developing it, we've discovered opportunities to speed up the process and reduce archival workload. For instance, recall the withdrawal information that must be filled in for every closed or redacted document. It consists of document type, correspondence name, subject, and chronological date. If we could automatically recognize the document types, we could automatically fill in the document type. And if we could recognize the form of the documents of a particular type, for example, a memo, we could extract the chronological date, the author's names, the addresses, and names, and the subject. Can fill these into the withdrawal form as well. This could save the archivist 15 to 30 seconds for every closed or redacted document and thus increase processing performance. If we could automatically recognize the document types and extract the information for the withdrawal form, we could also extract the same metadata for open records and use it to create item or record descriptions for all records. If items could be described, perhaps it would be possible to create descriptions for file units or folders. And having the descriptions for the folders, perhaps it would be feasible to create the series descriptions. This would aid the archivist in creating the scope and content notes for the finding aids. It would also allow archivists to focus on the more intellectually challenging task of review. This slide shows examples of some of the document types or documentary forms that we have discovered in the presidential textual records and that we see some of in the electronic environment. It represents perhaps a quarter of the document types to be found. How can we define the documentary forms so that we could automatically recognize them? How can we use the form of the document to extract the metadata needed to fill in withdrawal sheets and generate descriptions? The science of diplomatics gives us some useful concepts to address these research questions. First of all, documentary form consists of intellectual form and physical form. And these are these definitions from diplomatics are intentional definitions. We need really more operational definitions of what intellectual elements and physical elements are. In particular, intellectual elements are the textual elements that are common to a particular document type and that occur in similar positions in the document. For example, a date at the top of a memo, a caption such as memorandum 4, followed by one or more person's names, or a caption subject, followed by a colon, followed by a topic. Physical elements are attributes of intellectual elements. Attributes, physical elements would be such things as font, boldface, italics, underlines. Intellectual form is the pattern or structure of the intellectual elements. And physical form is the layout of the intellectual and physical elements. Linguists also give us some useful concepts to address these research questions. Grammars that can be used to define the syntactic form of sentences can also be used to define the intellectual form of records, and that's what we've demonstrated in our research. For instance, the grammar on this slide shows, in part, the form of a memo. A memo at the top, a memo consists of a memo head followed by a body. A memo head consists of a date, an address line, a sender line, and a subject line. Optionally, the address line may be followed by a through line, and so on. The intellectual elements are captions, such as from and subject. And they are also semantic categories, such as dates, persons' names, and titles. The physical elements are not shown in the grammar, but they consist of features, as I mentioned, such as font, font sizes, boldface, and underlines, that might be used in things like section titles in the body of a memo. A grammar such as shown in this example is defined for each of the document types. And so far, we've defined grammars for 22 of the document types that you saw in that list. So how can we automatically recognize the intellectual elements of a record and use the grammars to recognize the document type? Computational linguistics offers some concepts to address this question. The first five items on this slide show the names of a sequence of programs that have been used to annotate the dates, the job titles, postal addresses, and names of persons, location names. Oh, thank you. I forgot. Didn't see the grammar either. That's the grammar. There we go. So anyway, there are the first items in this list, as I said when you couldn't see the slide, are used to recognize dates, persons' names, location names. The last three, the first of the last three in italics, called intellectual element transducer, applies rules to the already annotated text of the semantic categories, such as person names and dates, to identify which of these annotations are intellectual elements. And it identifies additional intellectual elements, such as from followed by a colon, subject followed by a colon, paragraph, and CC, colon, etc. The result is a sequence of intellectual elements in a record. The next program name, Supple Parser, applies document type grammars to the sequence of intellectual elements. The result is a parse tree that represents the form of a document and whose root node is the name of the document type of the record. As the intellectual elements are parsed, a representation of the meaning of the document type is also created. The last program in the sequence, Extract Record Metadata, extracts the semantic representation for insertion into the withdrawal form or creation of an item description. This slide shows on the left a copy of a presidential record. On the right is shown a parse tree for the intellectual form of the record that was created by the Subl parser after having created the annotations of dates and persons' names and after having identified the intellectual elements. This is the parse tree created by the Subl parser. The parse tree indicates that the record has the documentary form of a memo. It also indicates that the date of the memo is April 27, 1992, and the person's name on the address line is Sam Skinner, and so on. The semantic representation of the meaning of the documentary form is shown below the parse tree. It states, E1 is a document, the document form of E1 is a memo, the author of E1 is Edie Holliday, the addressee of E1 is Sam Skinner, the topic of E1 is California earthquake, and the date of E1 is April 27, 1992. And all of this was created automatically. This slide shows the extracted record metadata inserted into the withdrawal information for a record. So the archivist now doesn't have to copy this from the record or type it in. On the right-hand side is shown an item description generated from the extracted metadata. So this might be the item description or an item title. Purpose meets many of the needs for processing presidential e-records, but more needs to be learned. Archivists have identified additional requirements and areas for experimentation. These include the Boolean search technique originally provided for PRA FOIA search can be cumbersome, and we are currently trying to develop a more advanced search technique that is less so. Archivists say that they need additional search criteria because some requests are limited to the records of a particular office or to records of a particular person. Other requests may be limited to records within certain dates. Other requests only need specific document types, such as letters or memoranda. Other requests need specific actions or topics. How should eFOIA collections be provided to library researchers? Should they be provided in the original formats? The difficulty with this policy would be that while viewers for these formats could be provided at the library, many researchers would not have access to these viewers on their computers. Should all word processing formats be converted to a single file format whose viewer is free and widely available? What about spreadsheets, databases, presentations, and images in different file formats? Which standard formats would be appropriate for distribution of these types of records? Experimentation is desirable, and the purpose prototype provides an environment for that experimentation. What issues arise in processing email in legacy and current email formats? Experience is also desirable there. And as Brooke mentioned earlier, purpose will eventually need the functional capability to notify proposed openings of presidential electronic records to the former and current presidential presidents or their representatives pursuant to the PRA. Okay, in summary, during the purpose research project, archivists and computer scientists have learned much about the requirements for processing presidential e-records that was not known before the project began. The purpose tools, either individually or as an integrated system, support many of the needs for processing e-records. In particular, accession, packaging and storage, file type identification, intellectual arrangement, preservation, search and retrieval, review, description, and creation of FOIA collections and finding aids. While purpose has been tested by archivists for systematic processing, though not demonstrated this morning, and for PRA FOIA processing of presidential e-records. The system is not operational and is experimental, and what we produce is case studies of the results. The purpose prototype provides an environment for learning new requirements for processing e-records and for discovering new opportunities for improving the process. Purpose is also an environment for exploring alternative preservation strategies, as well as an environment for applying advanced information technologies to archival tasks and experimentally evaluating their performance. Finally, though, the results of the Purpose Research Project have been helpful in determining the needs of archivists in dealing with electronic records, it's important to emphasize that this continues to be a research project. Thank you, and if you need additional information, you can get it from the Purpose website. If these particular reports are not up there today, they will be shortly. Thank you very much.
And before I open the floor for questions, I just want to emphasize what a privilege it has been working on this research project and to say that there is hope for dealing with electronic records once you have archivists and computer scientists and IT professionals coming to the table and really working together. I am computer savvy in terms of I can check my email, I can do what I need to do at work, and that's about it. And so when I started on this project, it was a little daunting. But whereas I had to translate things from archival language to language that Dr. Underwood can understand, he did the same for me. And I think in our interactions as archivists at the Bush Library, between me, Brooke, and other archivists who have worked on this system, and Dr. Underwood's team, we have made a lot of progress. And so I can't emphasize enough that if you come together and develop a common vocabulary, that you can accomplish much. So with that, I'm opening the floor for questions. I do want you to know that this session is being recorded, so once you ask a question, I will have to repeat it into the microphone so that it can be recorded. Go ahead.
When you're dealing with the automatic extraction of metadata, did you find that you need to do quality control or quality assurance afterward to determine how well the automation worked?
Let me repeat that question. When the system is doing automatic extraction of metadata to populate things like the withdrawal sheet, is there any kind of quality control or check that goes on to ensure that the information extracted is correct?
Is this mic working? Okay. Absolutely. And what we did not describe today is we perform experiments on a sample corpus where we know what the metadata should be for each of the records in the corpus, and then we look at what's automatically created, and then we come up with an evaluation. So if you get something like 90% correct, which would be good, very good, you'd like to have something more like 95 or 98, you're unlikely to ever get anything like 100%. And so what this really is a support tool. One use of the technology would be to give archivists earlier intellectual control of collections they have not been able to read, to have a better idea of what's in the collection. And for instance, for archival description, the archivists should generate the descriptions that are made available to the researchers. And so these are tools that can, after the archivist has reviewed thousands of records in a record series or a FOIA collection, it's a way of summarizing what's there to help them in creating the description.
Okay.
Do you expect to make some of these tools available to others for testing?
Do you expect to make some of these tools available for others?
It's a question that I often get, and we're exploring the possibility of doing that, but there is no specific plan as yet.
Right there.
This being a prototype, and you say you're still experimenting. Is there a timeline, time frame that you expect to take this thing as a live tool for NARA?
Is there a timeline for this system to move from the prototype to the actual working system? That's your question. I'll go ahead and answer that. There is not an established timeline for that, but this research is feeding into the ERA, which is going to go live, and portions of that system and functionality have already gone live. And so I can't give you a definite date on when this system will start up as a live system, but we're using the lessons learned from the system in a live system in the ERA. I will let Ken Thibodeau over there explain. Maybe you want to come and be able to speak into a mic, Ken. Do you want to?
I appreciate it.
Being archivist, you'll allow me to give a little context. The ERA research program has a fundamental rule that if it can be done, it's not research. In our research activities, we're only looking at stuff that's beyond state of the art, where in some cases, not only is there no technology, but in a lot of the stuff Bill Underwood is dealing with, computer science isn't even at the point of being able to figure out some of these problems. So we look at the research program for doing two things for us. First, it looks at the problems we're going to encounter a couple years down the road so that when we do encounter them, we have good information on how to approach them. Secondly, and much more substantially, we look to it for knowledge transfer. Examples of which you've seen here today in terms of knowledge transfer to our archivists about what's required, what's possible, put them in the position where they can make judgments and not just be at the mercy of IT people. But we also bring our researchers like Bill into the National Archives to talk to our engineers and also to talk directly with Lockheed Martin's engineers so they get the insights as well as all the publications. But we want that continuing stream of knowledge transfer. A little bit of a sidelight on that. What we built in ERA so far is infrastructure, the ability to have an archival system that can grow and get more complex and rich over time. We're getting to a phase where we're going to start looking for open source tools that we can put on top of our infrastructure to do things like this. Bill wasn't really hedging in answering the last question about will this tool be available. It's actually caught up in Army Legal Counsel's office because NARA avoids all the 90% of the overhead of managing research by going to other agencies that already do manage research, and we partner with them. And usually we do that so that they're paying 90% of the cost, which is nice. Last year, the Air Force asked if they could experiment with the purpose tools. And from Georgia Tech to NARA, we would have loved to have that happen, but it's still in the Army Legal Counsel's office, so we're waiting on them. But we definitely have a sense that not only do we want to transfer this to NARA, but we want to do things so that it becomes available to the archival community. To the extent that federal law and et cetera allows us.
Thank you, Ken. More questions? Right.
I have a question similar to the metadata question. Is your converting files from obsolete or unknown formats to usable format? Is there any indication of what may be lost, compromised? How are you ensuring that quality, that conversion?
So for the conversion of obsolete file formats into a readable, workable format, is there any kind of quality check to make sure or find out if anything's been lost or damaged?
Okay. The system is an environment for exploring that issue. So the idea would be to take some records in a particular format, convert them, use the converters to convert it to alternative formats, and then examine the results to see if there are changes in, let's say, the physical elements or the physical layout, or if information was lost or modified in some way. And that kind of experimentation is really critical, okay? And it's there's very few, if any, people doing it. And so what this really is an environment for that kind of study. And I hope that those studies will be performed.
I know I had a hand over here and one over here before.
Whenever this system might become available to the general public, do you think there's also going to be systems documentation, like a purpose cookbook? So, you know, it will provide a vehicle for archivists and our systems people to talk with each other?
So documentation of the process of developing?
Well, just systems documentation, and, you know, just so, you know, not only will we have the open source code, but also so we can develop workarounds specific to our own industry.
So when PURPOSE does become available to the public, will there be systems documentation and in addition to open source code, basically, is what you're asking?
I'll just say that at the present time, the documentation consists of a 200-page reference manual, online help, and a lot of system documentation as to the architecture. And what's still needed for new archivists who haven't used the system, who are coming to it to use it for the first time, is a better introduction and guidance, sort of a tutorial. It is sort of overwhelming to step into it, and because it's supporting, it's become very, when it started, it was very simple, but it's become very complex. But if there is some path to making this available, the plan would be to put together a team so that the open source code could be supported.
Okay.
But there is no such funding or plan at the present time.
I just wanted to make a humble request for that. A lot of lone arrangers are struggling. We don't have the type of IT support that the federal government has or larger academic institutions have. You know, we're lucky if we can just get our IT director to talk to us in between putting out fires. So
right.
Any documentation you can give us would be greatly appreciated.
Well, one thing, the most recent copy of the manual is not up on the website, but I will get it up there. It's been out for a year or two and still is not there. One use of that manual for people interested in requirements for our archival repositories and archival processing, even though they may be different than the requirements of the Presidential Library, is to look at the manual and abstract from it the requirements for their system, modulo, you know, the differences in their requirements. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the uses of prototyping, is to, through something like evolutionary prototyping, build a system that captures most of the functionality and then abstract from that the functional requirements for a new system that you want to design. And in a sense, that's one way it could influence ERA's development. Some of the functions that we've defined that are needed, the functionality could be abstracted and then built in different software, you know, for the ERA system.
Okay. More questions? Right here, back there, and right there, and I think we'll be out of time after that.
As I recall, the Bush presidency ended in 1992. Is that correct?
It ended January
2093. Okay. So we're looking at a system that is 15 years old right now?
I'm sorry.
No.
No.
System elements that are 15 years old or older.
Oh,
no.
The contents of?
Yes. And so the question I have is that each presidential library, as you move up in time, you're getting closer to real time in the sense of what's going on today. And the question I have is, when are you going to apply this to the Clinton Library, which is now what, word 5 or word 6 or word 4 or 5 that they're using, and then the current Bush Library, which will be in word 7 and all the other permutations of software that are out there today.
So,
are you thinking along this line?
I'm sorry, so your question is, when are we going to apply
Well, what I'm suggesting is that each presidential library encompasses an 8-year span or a 4-year span on the election time. Wouldn't it be appropriate to begin at the time that that presidential library is established to deal with all of these protocols?
Well,
and also go out and get the software and put it in a place so you don't have to build robots or reviewers or whatever.
Okay, so the question is about establishing protocols and having a system in place day one at a presidential library for that administration's electronic records. And I see Ken Thibodeau wants to answer that question. Do you want to just stay up here, Ken?
That's a really good question. You know, it just seems logical that, you know, this is a moving target.
Yeah.
And as each day goes by, software vendors are dying, going away. But the stuff is there today.
Yeah.
It won't be there 2 years or 3 years.
So we definitely want a systematic way of getting above all that. So we're not, you know, the Office of Presidential Libraries doesn't want to be in a position of supporting a separate system in every presidential library because you can't afford it.
Sure.
And then your archivists aren't interchangeable. They can't move because they only know one system. Yeah. So we've implemented in June a system for federal records. Our target date is something like November 20th. We will go to initial operating capability for what we call the search and access era system, which will support initially the Bush Library. Now, we're looking at something in excess of 100 terabytes being transferred on January 20th. So the reason it's called search and access is, you know, the library people tell us by noon on January 20th, the ex-president, the ex-president's staff, the Congress, the courts, they're going to be coming in with requests. So we want the stuff in and searchable. And it's not going to be all there by noon. And if it was, the poor archivists would be overwhelmed. But that system will have basic capabilities so that as quickly as possible the staff of the Bush Library and the library staff that's in Washington can do full-text searches on that 100 terabytes plus of data. But we're designing it in such a way that we can then bring in a variety of different tools, such as the ones, and Bill's tools are extendable and evolvable over time, so it's not that he's got a system that represents technology from the 1980s. He's using beyond state-of-the-art technology to deal with records from the 1980s. It's not proof of the pudding, but we have a very good index right now that approach, that the system we're developing can be adapted to other presidential libraries. We're talking to the people who are responsible for congressional archives at the National Archives, and they think they can use this system almost out of the box. So we think we do have an expandable approach. So I'll stay in the front row.
Yes, thank you, Ken. But, I mean, that is the point of ERA, is to make access, to provide access for these records no matter the format, no matter the administration. And so that is something that they are thinking of in the development of that system. So I know I had a question back here and one up here.
So my question is about chronological dates.
Okay.
For born digital records, if there is not a date in a memo, it's just not something that's readily apparent in the document itself, is there any way to extract that date of creation, that date of recordness? Because as I understand it, as the records are transferred from one system to the next, it takes on
So the question is regarding chronological date. If there is not a date within the text of the record itself, is there a way to extrapolate the creation date of an electronic record?
Okay. When acquiring electronic records from computer systems, it's important to use the right tools so that you maintain things like the date last modified. I think what you're alluding to is often as you migrate or as you move a file system or files from one computer system to another, new dates may be created for the files. And you can lose records of the date last created. And we've considered that in the research project so that we have procedures that maintain the original date created. And among other things, we capture the original date created and put it into a manifest of metadata about the files. The other thing is to, of course, maintain, you're looking at the archivist will tell you that if they look at the records in context and see that this memo fits into a sequence of communications, they can get an idea of the chronological date. So that'd be a non-technological but archival approach.
And our last question up here.
One of your bullet points on things that you're looking forward to working on said that you're going to be looking at the problems that you might encounter with email. And I was just wondering, besides things like attachments and maybe aliases and address lists, what other things do you think that you might run into that would be problematic?
The question is, what other issues about emails outside of attachments could you encounter?
There are so many. The first is the evolution of email systems, you know, over the last 20 years, so that you have different protocols for representing the form of the memo. So there's difference in what was stored and how the email was managed between profs and all-in-one and ARMS and Microsoft Exchange, which are and Lotus Notes, which are five of the email systems that were used have been used with presidential records. I will just say that I'll confess ignorance and say that there needs to be more research and experimentation of the type that we're doing, I think, with email collections. And I saw some of that reported, as a matter of fact, at this conference. There's beginning to be some reports of, we need more email practice and experience research and presentations because there's so many different email environments and email systems. So I really can't, other than the issues you brought up, which are important issues, I'll just say there needs to be more research in the area.
And I'll just piggyback on that, that you don't know what the issues are until you're in the middle of it. Like, you have an idea what the challenges will be, and then there are things that, as archivists, we never thought would be an issue, but in the electronic world, oh, wow, we have to think about that now. And once we've made a decision on this issue, oh, that opens up three more questions. And so it's definitely an adventure. So with that, I'd like to thank you and enjoy the rest of the conference. If you have any and if you have any further questions, I think we'll stick around for a few more minutes before the next session.